headlines. The boycott, divestment, sanctions movement says that Israel's practices towards Palestinians amounts to apartheid. Iran says U.S. sanctions must be removed in practice, not on paper, as it once again dismisses any sequencing mechanism to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. And the European Commission launches legal action against AstraZeneca over violating its contractual obligations to supply EU member states with COVID vaccine. This is News. Thanks for joining us. A leading social justice movement that seeks to end the oppression of Palestinians has come down hard on Israel for its recent harsh crackdown in the West Bank.
Israel's practices towards Palestinians amount to an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination. Definition of apartheid under Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court.
The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement also called on the UN to take action to end Israel's violence and impose sanctions on the regime. The group slammed the European Union for its stance towards Israel's assault against Palestinians. It said, quote, Israeli fascists mount a violent program against Palestinians, but the EU calls for calm. Israel has intensified its crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied territories over the past days. The regime's forces have wounded hundreds of Palestinians and arrested dozens. Social media users have been reacting to the escalation of tensions in the occupied Jerusalem, Mount Quds, and the West Bank as Israeli forces tightened restrictions on Palestinian worshippers during the holy month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians have been arrested or injured while protesting the curbs. Ali Reza Ekhtiarzadeh from Hashtag Trending brings us more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. What seems to be the hot topic these days on social media is an Israeli humiliation in the occupied Palestinian territories during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Tensions have been high in the city of Jerusalem al-Quds after Israel tightened restrictions on Palestinian worshippers. Every year during the fasting month of Ramadan, Palestinians hold usual evening gatherings outside the Al-Quds Old City's Damascus Gate. But this year, Israeli forces erected metal barriers there and restricted Palestinian worshippers, and also launched a crackdown on protests against the curb. Over 100 Palestinians have been injured in the unrest since the start of Ramadan. All right, now let's check out some tweets and reactions as the world watches Israeli violation in occupied Palestinian territories. Many believe that such violations aren't any different from the crimes committed by the Nazis. Here we have our first comment by Bill Stapleton, who wrote, "Can somebody explain to me how these people are different from the Nazis?" The next one comes from Two on Track, who wrote, "Armed thugs against unarmed civilians as usual. Western media always becomes blind when it comes to Israeli Zionist extremists." On to the next comment by Times of Gaza. They wrote, "Israeli occupation forces arrest the Palestinian man Nedal Asfour after beating him in the old city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds." My Name is Teague wrote, "A Palestinian youth threw a stone at point-blank range at the face of one of cowardly Israeli forces in Jerusalem, Al-Quds." Social media is filled with pictures and videos of the harsh techniques used by the Israeli police to crack down on unarmed Palestinian protesters. These violent behaviors have caused a lot of angry tweets to come up on social media. Let's check out some of them. The first one by Miles Vance, which reads, "Police in Israel hate Palestinians more than racists in America hate people of color." I on Palestine wrote, "Israeli occupation soldiers brutally detaining Palestinian young in the old city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds." And here we have another instance of police brutality against the Palestinians. The comment comes from I on Palestine again, who wrote, "Israeli occupation forces detained two Palestinian girls after assaulting them at Damascus Gate in the occupied city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds." All right, on to our final comment of the day, which comes from Come On The Hoops, who wrote, "Most dangerous nation of the planet's back. Disgusting that the rest of the world sits back and watches as this happens." All right, that's been it for me and today's edition of Hashtag Trending. It's time to get back to the studio now. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Iran says that it will not allow the nuclear negotiations in Vienna to drag on, and will leave the talks if it believes that other parties lack seriousness. Vienna is hosting all parties to the 2015 nuclear deal to find ways to save the accord after the U.S. left it in 2018. Iran's foreign minister says that Iran and Iraq will stand together as he holds talks with his Iraqi counterpart in Baghdad. Mohammad Javad Zarif said that the two countries have good ties in the economy and other sectors. He said that Baghdad holds a pivotal role in the region. The Iraqi foreign minister, Fuad Hussein, said that his country seeks to expand ties with the regional countries based on common interests. Zarif also paid a visit to the site where senior Iranian commander general Qasem Soleimani and the top Iraqi PMU official Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes were assassinated in a U.S. strike last year. The top Iranian diplomat traveled to Baghdad one day after visiting Doha as part of his regional tour. He held talks with the Qatari mayor and foreign minister to discuss bilateral relations and hold regional and extra-regional negotiations. Iraqi affairs expert Navid Behrouz says that in his visit to Baghdad, Iran's foreign minister has expressed his country's support for a strong and stable Iraq.
Mr. Zarif emphasized that Iran supports the pivotal role played by Iraq in the region and the efforts by Iraq for bringing closer together the views and eliminating tension in the region. Iran supports a strong and stable Iraq and also expansion of bilateral relations were emphasized. Mr. Zarif said that the 4+1 talks in Vienna is proceeding and expressed hope that the United States would act in a rational manner and take steps for returning to the nuclear deal. He underscored that in his talks with Mr. Fuad Hussein, he raised bilateral issues and also discussed expansion of political and cultural relations and economic relations. He emphasized that eventually these are the regional states that will remain and the foreigners will leave this region.
The European Commission says it has lodged legal action against the British-Swedish pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca over the delivery of coronavirus vaccines.
Indeed, the Commission has started last Friday a legal action against the company AstraZeneca on the basis of breaches of the advance purchase agreement. The reason indeed being that the terms of the contract or some terms of the contract have not been respected and the company has not been in a position to come up with a reliable strategy to ensure the timely delivery of doses. What matters to us in this case is that we want to make sure that there is a speedy delivery of a sufficient number of doses that European citizens are entitled to.
In response, AstraZeneca said the legal action is without merit, stressing that it has fully complied with its agreement with the European Commission. The company also vowed to put up a strong defense in court. Under an advance purchase deal, AstraZeneca had agreed to deliver 180 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines to the EU in the second quarter of 2021. However, the company said last month that it would deliver only a third of the agreed jabs. The firm blamed the delays in its supplies on technical problems at its manufacturing plants in Belgium. Britain's Prime Minister is facing calls to resign over his coronavirus policies last year and allegations on his inappropriate lobbying and special favors for personal gains. Boris Johnson came under pressure after media reports cited him as saying that he would rather see bodies pile high in their thousands than impose a third national lockdown. That was before he was forced to introduce the restrictions in January to curb soaring fatalities. Also, his former aide, Dominic Cummings, has revealed that the Premier sought to use potentially illegal donations to renovate his official accommodation in London. The opposition Labour Party has demanded an urgent inquiry. The Scottish National Party has also called for a parliamentary questioning of Johnson, saying that he must resign if the allegations are true. Iran has registered a new record number of COVID-19 fatalities since November. The Iranian Health Ministry said that 496 people have died of the coronavirus in the past 24 hours, bringing the total death toll to well over 70,000. More than 21,000 new infections were also reported. The overall cases in the country have surpassed 2.4 million. Iran has seen a rapid surge in infections since late March. Authorities blame the hike on more contagious strains of the virus and lax observation of health protocols during the New Year holidays. This comes as a national lockdown remains in place to curb the spread of the disease. Hundreds of Iranian cities are marked as dangerous or highly dangerous in terms of infections. India has been breaking the global record of daily coronavirus cases for over the past several days. with hospitals in major cities being overwhelmed with patients. Both the public and government officials have been blamed for the spike. We discussed the situation on the ground with our guests in the News Review program. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the News Review section. India has broken the global record of daily coronavirus infections for the fifth straight day as it's registered nearly 353,000 new cases. Total number of COVID infections has breached the green milestone of 17.3 million. India has also registered its highest daily record of fatalities with over 2,800 new deaths. Several countries have pledged to send medical aid to help India tackle the crisis, hoarding oxygen and vital medicine in homes is worsening the situation, and that's while hospitals are overwhelmed with patients in major cities and many facing a shortage of oxygen supplies and beds. Officials blame the spike on public reluctance to observe social distancing and other health protocols. Now, to get a better picture of what's really going on in India, we have a couple of guests from India. We have our correspondent, Munawar Zaman, in New Delhi. Also, we're joined by Yogesh Jain, public health physician and co-founder of People's Health Support Group, who's joining us from Bilaspur. Good to have both of you on the show. Let's go to New Delhi to Munawar. Munawar, so what's really going on there in India? Government is saying that the people are not wearing masks and people are blaming the government. You know, we have oxygen shortages and serious ones. So what's going on the ground there?
Of course, I know very well, and everybody knows that when the pandemic was retreating in the month of October 2020, we remember, people started taking things easily. So did the government. The government started being overconfident. They believed that we have overcome the situation, and they threw out open markets, they opened their economic sectors as well, and they also announced that now we have rolled out the vaccination programs, we are also exporting the vaccination. We have made a tremendous progress in addressing the crisis of the coronavirus, but they underestimated everything. They did anticipate the second wave is going to be disaster for the country. Because you already know that India has a huge, massive geographical country, has also the second most population in the world. At the same time, when you have huge population, your healthcare system is ailing. You don't have healthcare structure, not only on the urban areas, but we're talking about rural areas as well. Our healthcare system here in India is so dismal because the expenditure or the overall expenditure on the health system is less than 2% of GDP. Just imagine the fact that you are addressing a health crisis for a population of more than 1.3 billion. How would you address such a crisis? Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems that the administration didn't learn lessons from the developed nations such as Italy, the United Kingdom, and other countries that were handling the crisis. They were in an overconfident mode. At the same time, the problem that right now the country is facing is the acute shortage of oxygen, the acute shortage of beds, because you don't have spaces in the hospitals. I mean, if we see what is happening outside the hospitals in India, it is absolutely heart-wrenching. It's heartbreaking to see people begging for the lives of their loved ones. Please give us the oxygen. Please give us the beds. I mean, the situation is so alarming that you don't feel like going to the hospitals. You break down. I mean, you're conscious, dear about. I mean, you see what's happening with the people, their relatives, the near ones and dear ones. Mm-hmm. Back to you.
Okay, now let me ask about Dr. Jain. So what's the problem? You know, is it public awareness? Is it mismanagement on the part of government? Because this has been more than a year since the world has been hit by coronavirus. So oxygen has always been a vital supply. So why should we be facing such serious, serious problems in India?
So I think I would score it in one word, the lack of preparedness to handle crises, and in this case a pandemic, defining feature of the entire world's situation, and very much with India too, whether preparing for an oxygen need
of the nature that we have at the moment is part of that lack of preparedness that we have had. But it is also doing a surveillance for the number of new cases that emerge every week that gives you a warning for the next episode, for the next weeks. Or just shutting off of care systems, not being prepared, being prepared for a routine number of patients, but also a surge is something that our systems have not actually matured enough to do this, and this, we are facing the consequences of this. And I'm really worried for rural India, where when the surge really hits, after it has hit the cities of India, what will be the consequence for them?
Exactly, and we're getting this Indian version of the virus, which is much more, fatal. And so, doctor, it's been more than 14, 15 months. I wonder why India should not be prepared for that. So what's the way out? Can India handle this on its own, or it does need international contribution? What's the way out?
So the way out at the moment is that we have to change our strategy to a mitigation strategy at the moment, not go into the containment or control strategy that we started with. And at this moment, our priority should be to prevent deaths from happening, and those who need to get care of a differential care, oxygen-based care for the ones who are sick, and the ones who are not sick, we monitor them at home level. That has to be streamlined, and forget about now testing too much or containing the disease.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Munawar Zaman, our correspondent, joined us from New Delhi. And we also had Yoga Shane, public health physician and co-founder of People's Health Support Group from Bilaspur, India, with his contribution.
And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Continent.
Hi everyone, this is Don, and I welcome you back to another episode of the Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the region of South Asia, which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of the Subcontinent, we are going to talk about Russian Foreign Minister's visit to India and Pakistan, as well as its significance for the geopolitics of Asia. And we shall take a look at the recent nationwide protests in Pakistan and why Islamabad banned a hardline religious group in the country.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently visited India and then went to Pakistan. Lavrov's visit may herald a new era of ties with the subcontinent. Apart from the significance of Moscow's move to mend the frayed relations with the Asian countries, The visits can potentially impact Washington's policies regarding Islamabad and New Delhi.
Earlier this month, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov took a two-day trip to India, where he met his Indian counterpart, Subramaniam Jaishankar. Lavrov then traveled to Pakistan from New Delhi. Moscow says a special and privileged strategic partnership with India is one of Russia's foreign policy priorities. And during their joint press conference, the two foreign ministers reiterated the time-tested nature as well as the remarkable resilience of their bilateral ties in the face of the increasing difficulties that have marred their relations in recent times. 2020 was especially troubled for India-Russia ties as their annual summit was cancelled for the first time in two decades. Although the respective ministries said that the summit was cancelled because of the COVID-19 pandemic, some reports speak of more other reservations, because throughout the pandemic, India held bilateral and multilateral meetings virtually with other partners. Jaishankar and Lavrov talked about the International North-South Transport Corridor and the Chennai-Vladivostok Eastern Maritime Corridor. But many believe that the focus of Lavrov's visit to the region was on the Afghanistan peace process. In Islamabad, Lavrov said that Russia and Pakistan had convergent positions on the Afghan peace process.
All right, now let's look at the map of Asia. The North-South Transport Corridor is the 72,000-kilometer-long multimode network of ship, rail, and road routes for moving freight between Russia, Azerbaijan, Iran, and India. The objective of the corridor is to increase trade connectivity between major cities such as Mumbai, Moscow, and Tehran, among others. Traditionally, the Indo-Russian strategic partnership has been built on five major components: politics, defense and military equipment, civil nuclear energy, anti-terrorism cooperation, and space technology. However, in recent years, a sixth economic component has grown in importance, with both countries setting a target of reaching $30 billion in bilateral trade by 2025, from about $9.4 billion in the year 2017. India is the second largest market for Russian defense industry. In 2017 alone, approximately 68% of Indian military hardware came from Russia, making Russia the chief supplier of defense equipment. According to a poll in 2014, almost 85% of Russians viewed India positively, while only 9%, a very small chunk, viewed them negatively. Similarly, a 2017 opinion poll by the Moscow-based non-governmental think tank Levada Center states that Russians identified India as one of their top five friends, with the others being Belarus, China, Kazakhstan, and Syria.
There have been substantial shifts in the geopolitical dynamics of global powers in recent years, with differences deepening between the US and China and the US and Russia. This is while Sino-Russian ties are, in Lavrov's words, the highest in history, and China and India are well set to become economic powerhouses before mid-century, thus playing significant strategic roles in their regions and beyond. Therefore, the United States needs new policies to balance Russia's closer connections to Pakistan and India. Lavrov was unable to meet Prime Minister Narendra Modi in Delhi because the latter was campaigning in West Bengal, although John Kerry, the U.S. presidential envoy, did manage a meeting the following day. During the joint presser with Lavrov, Jaishankar's mind was so preoccupied with Washington's reaction that when he was describing the cordial nature of the relationship, he said India-US instead of India-Russia.
...of India-US relations.
Now, to learn more about the Russian foreign minister's visit to India and Pakistan, we are joined by Mr. Mark Sloboda. He's the international relations and security analyst. Mr. Sloboda, welcome to this show. So, what is the significance of Lavrov's visit to the subcontinent?
Okay, so Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's visit to India and then to Pakistan was has been primarily billed as an attempt to reset Russian-Indian relations after there is some indication that in the last few years they have moved farther and farther apart. There is an annual Russian-Indian summit that is usually held. The summit was canceled last year, ostensibly because of the coronavirus crisis, which does make a certain amount of sense. But there's also a lot of talk, particularly in Moscow, that the Kremlin was not looking forward to the meeting anyway and was happy to cancel it to signal its displeasure at the Indian moving strategically into cooperation with the Quad, with the United States, directed against China, whatever they India may make denials about, and this Indo-Pacific policy. Russia regards this as a attempt to form an Asian NATO, and that the grouping not only threatens China, which is Russia's strong strategic partner now, but also the Russian position in the Pacific as well. So this meeting was an attempt to, I would say, rather than reset, to manage a minimum amount of maintenance to the Russian-Indian relationship. But the two have moved quite far apart. In the last 4 or 5 years, in 2014, when Modi first came to office, he was quite famously asked about the relationship, and he said that if he asked any Indian child which country is the greatest friend of India, and that it would be Russia, because they have been to the Russia has always been there in times of crisis for India.
Okay, so how is the current status of India-Russia ties? Did Lavrov's India trip reset the ties to a better direction? Does Lavrov's trip mean anything really in terms of the dynamics of Russia's relations with India?
Yeah, I don't think that there is any positive change because of Lavrov's trip to India. In fact, Lavrov was unable, presumably, to meet with the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, supposedly because he was campaigning in West Bengal. And Lavrov met instead only with his counterpart, the Indian Foreign Minister. However, the very next day, the U.S.'s special, President Biden's special climate envoy, John Kerry, who was formerly the U.S. Secretary of State under Obama, he did meet with Modi. So that is makes clear the priorities, strategic priorities of India's prime minister in this situation. Whereas when Lavrov then went to Pakistan, he met with both the Pakistani defense minister and the Pakistani prime minister Khan. That is Islamabad clearly signaling that Russia is higher in their priority than Russia is for India. And that's not a good indication.
How would these visits impact India-U.S. relationship? How would the United States see and react to such developments?
I think the United States will look very favorably on the outcome of Lavrov's visit to India, the awkwardness that was clear, the failure to make any kind of breakthrough, and even the failure of Lavrov to meet with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. There has been some suggestion that the U.S. demanded of India that they do not allow a meeting between their prime minister and the Russian foreign minister. That is, you know, purely speculation. But there is no question that the United States has ever-increasing influence on India, and that India is being incredibly receptive to that influence. While Lavrov was there, the Indian foreign minister made clear to say that it regards It is looking for inclusive cooperation, and it is not directed against anyone, and that its relationships with Russia are not dependent on, or Russia or any other country are not dependent on its relations with any third country. Well, that is clearly false. That is a false statement, because quite definitely, India's relationships with other countries is now determined by what the United States wants and dictates. One clear example of that is that India, which was a major purchaser of Iranian oil in mid-2019 at the demands of the United States, stopped purchasing Iranian oil because of the U.S. Trump administration's unilateral illegal sanctions imposed on Iran as the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. So that's India quite clearly working against its own energy interests and energy security, a long relationship with Iran at the demands of the United States.
Thank you so much, Mr. Sriboda, for being with us on our show. It was nice having you here. Let's take a quick look at how people on social media and cyberspace have reacted to this development. Please stay with us.
Riyaz Haq has wrapped up all the important feats of the Russian foreign minister to the subcontinent. Nutan Nihar has highlighted the role of the West in Moscow's ties with India. Ahmed Qureshi has pointed out that Afghanistan is a converging issue where all of the involved countries are working together. Akhtar Navid Sayed has responded to another post, noting that the United States is the only player in Afghanistan that is not from the region. He says Washington is the imperialist in this game. Bilal Ahmed Ghaffar has elaborated on the Russian blank check for India, citing gas pipelines, corridors and defense cooperation as some areas of interest.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Islamabad has banned Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan amid violent anti-France protests by the far-right party. Although this group has terrorized religious minorities in Pakistan, including Shias, by the way, over bogus charges of blasphemy, its demand of boycotting French products and expelling the French envoy is not totally unwarranted. After all, it is the French Islamophobia that is fueling this anger and outrage across the country as well as the world.
Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, or TLP, is an extremist group with a history of atrocities on religious minorities within the country. However, the group was not banned until mid-April in the midst of large and violent protests against France. Despite the government's measures under the country's Anti-Terrorism Act of 1997, the group threatened further demonstrations if Islamabad did not comply with its demands. Since November, the group has been calling for the expulsion of the French ambassador and a ban on all French goods over repeated incidents of blasphemous sacrilegious remarks against Muslim Prophet Muhammad and their official patronage by the French government. Earlier in the month, police arrested TLP chief Saad Rizvi, the son of party founder Khadim Hussein Rizvi, who died of natural causes shortly after the November protests. The arrest sparked days of unrest, with thousands of TLP supporters launching protests and blocking roads and highways across the country. The protests by the TLP continued in pockets across the country last week, with Interior Minister Sheikh Rashid confirming that several policemen had been killed and kidnapped, while hundreds of others were wounded by demonstrators.
The Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan came into existence and subsequently rose to fame after the hanging of Mumtaz Qadri, the person who killed Punjab Governor Salman Taseer. Masses of TLP supporters came in support of Mumtaz Qadri, calling him a fallen hero instead of a killer. The group, whose members mainly belong to the Bareilly School of Islamic Thought, is known for its countrywide street power and massive protests in opposition to change to Pakistan's blasphemy law.
11B ke tahat Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan.
The Pakistani government declared Tehreek-e-Labbaik a terrorist organization and carried out a couple of security operations against its protesting followers, but the group is not willing to settle down on anything short of expulsion of French ambassador. The rallies are going on somehow unabated, while the public outrage against the French acts of sacrilege has given a stronger footing to the TLP. The government of Imran Khan is now weighing its choices to handle the situation, while the anti-France sentiments are still on the rise in Pakistan. The government has resumed negotiations with the TLP, but it seems to be running out of options but to rescind the ban on the activities of this political and religious outfit.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Muzammil Maqbool. He's the founder of Rumi Center for Global Peace. Mr. Maqbool, starting off, why has Islamabad banned Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan? What is this group and what do they want? What is the cause of the recent violent protests in Pakistan?
Islamabad banned TLP recently, and there were a lot of reasons. You know, first of all, the reason is that in this Islamist group is, you know, trying to intervene in the matters of the federal government. You know, they are trying to tame the government in a lot of issues. For example, when Charlie Hebdo cartoons were published, the government promised this party that, you know, they will take this matter internationally and they will make sure that these issues should be raised, issues like Islamophobia, racial slurs and issues against the article of faith about our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. But then, you know, they started intervening into government matters, taming the government, telling them that, you know, giving them ultimatums, which is actually wrong. So we are not dealing with Ummah, we are dealing with a nation, a sovereign nation like Pakistan. And in a nation, if you will tame a federal government and tell them what to do and what not to do, creates a lot of problems. So this compelled Ministry of Interior Affairs and Ministry of Home Affairs to go ahead and ban this organization under the Terrorist Act. This organization is nothing but hardline, hardcore Islamist organization who believes that, you know, Sharia law, the hardcore Sharia law, should be implemented across the nation, across Pakistan, and they have always been anti-minority when it comes to Shias, when it comes to Hazaras, when it comes to Ahmadis in Pakistan. And they sort of have created a paradigm in minds of people across the world, that especially in Pakistan, that these are the only people who love Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and they try to create or present a narrative of Islam which is totally wrong. You know, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is prophet for you, prophet for me, and everyone else. He has been a merciful man ever sent to this entire universe by Almighty Allah. So this is what it is, and our Prophet Muhammad is Rahmatul Alameen for everyone. But the narrative they set is that, you know, they only know how to love Prophet, how to show love for Prophet, and how to handle Islam is totally wrong. So this actually made the entire federal government to go ahead and ban this entire TLP, Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan.
What can Pakistan do about nationwide protests against diplomats or authorities of another country? In this case, France.
nationwide protests. You know, Pakistan tried to do a lot of things, you know, before these protests, before the TLP hit the streets. So they spoke with them in the month of November, December, January, and February as well. And they promised TLP, Khan's government promised TLP that, you know, they would discuss this entire issue in parliament. But before that, TLP were openly and covertly trying to, you know, plan to hit the streets of Islamabad and occupy every street, lane, and road. Pakistan tried their best to make sure that, you know, they will try to bridge the gap in between TLP and the federal government, but things could not work out. That is the reason, you know, they banned them. But then there has been an n number of requests, n number of, you know, discussions by the federal government, you know, with TLP to stop these protests. The best thing federal government can do right now to reach other people of the TLP, like there are other spokespersons, there is Amir and a deputy Amir of TLP. They can reach other people and try to break down things slowly. This is what can happen. And secondly, as I was going through the speech of, you know, Imran Khan today, he promised that he will raise the Islamophobia issue around the world and make sure that, you know, all the countries around the world will stop playing with the emotions, stop playing on the article of faith, which is related to our religion and Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and will make sure that, you know, it should not happen again. And he also promised the entire nation that, you know, he wants other OIC members, you know, 50 plus odd countries who are in OIC, he wants them to intervene in this issue and make sure that, you know, it should get stopped once for all. Like the Holocaust thing happened, and, you know, no one talks about that, and even in many countries, you know, it's banned. People get jailed if they talk about Holocaust. So these things, you know, the Pakistan government has to be preempt on this and give a lot of assurance right now to these leaders and the deputy leaders, emirs of this TLP, and make sure that, you know, things should settle down as soon as possible. And at the same time, you know, there is a lot of work and a lot of machinery work which Pakistan government have to start as soon as possible. And they have to speak with these spokespersons, with these main founding members of TLP who have founded this in 2016, and make sure that things should settle down as soon as possible. As a sovereign nation, Pakistan has to go ahead and make sure that, you know, they will break the communication barrier, which is getting bigger and bigger every minute passing by.
All right, that marks the end of this session. Thank you so much, Mr. Baghmul, for being with us. Now let's see what people have said online about TLP and the protests in Pakistan.
Ruhan Ahmed has shared the list of banned groups in which the TLP has been added. The Defense 360 account has talked about the government's inability to handle the pro-TLP protests, saying that Pakistan's elite forces have been deployed across the country to control the rallies. Imar Khan has underlined that Pakistan's religious scholars have never condoned the protests by the TLP and its followers. Hina Qureshi says the protests were aggravated following the arrest of the extremist group's young leader.
All right, that was our episode about some latest developments across the subcontinent, from the Russian foreign minister visit to India and Pakistan, as well as the violent anti-France protests throughout Pakistan. We will meet next week. Thank you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. Cause Ramadan is here. Whoa, Ramadan is here. Today's lesson: prayers in the month of Ramadan. By bringing upon tongue and chewing up the phrases and sentences which are perceived as lies, one should not treat Allah as a plaything or mockery, because speaking to Allah in this manner in accordance with the degree of reason and wisdom is close to blasphemy. Rather, if one thinks well, it is nothing but blasphemy. If our actions do not sync up with our words, with our prayers, with our du'as and supplications, we are in problem, we are in trouble. Brothers and sisters, one of the things we all need to try to attain is to understand the supplications of the month of Ramadan and train and tame ourselves to be in line and in sync with those supplications. Otherwise, we are going to face the consequences which are very serious in nature. In front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whose vast, infinite knowledge comprehends everything, and who is more aware than our own selves about all of our esoteric and exoteric affairs, we stand, stretch our hand in prayer, offering excuse by saying the following: O Allah, you commanded me not to sin and transgress. Instead, I most boldly trampled your command and stood up in rebellion against you. But in spite of all that, you preserved my honor by not exposing my shameful deeds and insulting me before others.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing about prayers in the month of Ramadan. We recite all kinds of prayers, but the question is, are our actions and is our state of heart in line and in sync with these prayers or not? Well, we pray to Allah that, you know, we inform and we confess that we have sinned and transgressed, but do we really feel shameful about it? In spite of saying these words, in our hearts, do we believe our actions and deeds, do they confirm and certify whatever is being uttered by our tongues? Our crying and shedding tears, earthiness and humility, which are all prerequisite for uttering the du'as, are not shown by us. Or worse than that, we consider ourselves as righteous and faithful servants, or feel sad regarding what Allah has done with us. Then, with such state of affairs, would it be appropriate and decent to utter such words by our tongues? Think about it. Do any wisdom and thinking regard such a behavior reasonable? And the one behaves in this manner and speaks so, what does he deserve? Let us take a pause in order to better discover our being ungrateful, unthankful, and disobedient. Allah, who is our Lord and Master, has invited us for a feast of His benevolence and generosity, allowing us to sit near His favorite saints. He has required us to stand before Him for benediction and supplication in order to be benefited from the table of His blessings and benevolence.
Forgive me for everything I've done in the past, when everything was going so fast, and now I just can't go on.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.